Blair Palmer, and welcome to the Punks in Suits podcast, bringing the leadership thinking, beliefs, philosophies, and practices behind punky, startup-y, next stage businesses to you, even if your company's not quite there yet. Hello, and welcome to episode 33 of the Punks in Suits podcast. I hope you're very well. Today's show is an interview from the archives. Last year, as part of my early research for the Punks in Suits book, which is still not finished, by the way, I talked to today's guest, Tom Nixon. We recorded the interview. I recorded all the interviews that I did for the book so that I'd have them for reference. And I put them online because I thought they were really interesting. And this one with Tom was the first one I did. And I just thought, I really want to share this. This is great. And in fact, it was doing this and a few of the other interviews that I did at the same time that gave me the idea of doing a podcast in the first place. But when I launched the podcast properly with all the music and a little introduction at the beginning and the bits of Ivy at the end, these didn't really fit in. They weren't in the same format. And at the time, I didn't have time to kind of re-edit them and repackage them. So I took them down off the website. However, I've dug this one back up because I think it is excellent. Now, I say more about who Tom is at the start of the interview, but in summary, he's a company founder who now coaches and supports other founders to create successful businesses that they're proud of. One concept to listen out for is the concept of the source. And even if you're not a company founder, you can be the source in your organization. So listen out to what Tom has to say about the role of this really important person in a business. You certainly don't have to be running your own business to get great ideas from this interview. There's so much, you almost want to listen to it with a notepad and a pen. I should point out, I hardly speak in this interview, partly because I was interviewing Tom for the book and partly because he has so much to share that's of value, I didn't want to interrupt him. So without further delay, let's get on with the show. So I'd like to welcome Tom Nixon. Tom is an advisor to founders, people who, in his words, are the source of their organization, people who've set up their own business, entrepreneurs. And before that, he was a founder himself, one of the founders of Nixon McInnes, Europe's first dedicated social business consultancy, working with clients like Coca-Cola and Barclays and WWF. And he's really a thought leader when it comes to helping organizations to hold on to the passion of their founder, helping founders to do that. So I think he's the perfect person to talk to about leadership and the kind of leadership that we need now. So welcome.
Thanks, Claire. I'll try my best.
So tell me first of all a little bit about the work that you do now and what drew you to that work, what draws you to it still.
So my story is that, as you mentioned, I was a founder myself, and so I spent 15 years building and running a company. And so experienced a lot of the ups and downs and the highs and lows that founders and leaders experience when they're trying to bring an idea into the world. And through that, I got fascinated as to why sometimes it's just damn hard and it just doesn't seem to work, why you go through periods where you're de-energized and don't really know quite why you're there. And at the same time, you go through other stages where everything seems to be flowing and the right people seem to be drawn to your initiative. The idea seems to be emerging in the world. And so through my own, I guess, bitter experience, I became fascinated in the subject. I've since been involved in an action research project where we've spoken to hundreds of founders of initiatives of all kinds, looking at what are the characteristics and principles that sometimes cause an idea to emerge and actually happen in the world, and why sometimes things falter, get stuck, or go off track. And so the focus of my work now is working with primarily founders, but also sometimes people who've taken over from founders, where there's been a succession, and giving them the benefit of my experience, but also the research. And the whole thing is focused on how we can make big ideas actually happen and actually emerge into the world. There's always an idea behind every human initiative, and sometimes it appears and sometimes it doesn't. And so, yeah, I'm interested in working with founders who want to realize an idea, and I'm helping them to avoid some of the common tensions and problems and to hopefully have a more of a state of flow where things do seem to be working.
Yeah. So your focus is on what you call the source. Can you maybe describe what the source is?
Yeah, so there's a really vital role of any human initiative. So this is certainly true for businesses, but it's just as true for a party or a house share arrangement or any other human initiative that you can think of. It all starts with a person who has an idea, and they have enough enthusiasm or passion or energy, whatever word you want to use, for that idea, that they take the first step. They take some kind of risk to start to bring the idea into the world. And so a couple of interesting things that we've found, and certainly have run true from my own experience, is firstly that it's an individual. So there are many stories where people say, we started this thing together. And they say that for the right reasons. Usually there's humility, there's humbleness, there's an acknowledgement that they couldn't do it alone. But when you look really carefully, you can find that it was really one person that took the first step. And that's quite an important point, which we'll probably come back to. And secondly, the fortunes of the initiative, whether you like it or not, seem to be really tied to that individual. And when the idea is being realized, and when the person who is the source of the initiative is fully taking responsibility, they're doing the thing that they've got passion and energy for, then things are much more likely to be flowing. And so it's a very interesting subject to study, because you start to look for who is the person who's really holding this thing, and focus a little bit on them, and then the initiative has a much greater chance of actually succeeding, of actually the idea getting realized.
So I can understand that in a small or in a relatively new company, that person is quite easy to find. A lot of people work in really big 60,000 person organizations, global organizations that have been around for 50 years, 100 years, 200 years. Do they still have a source?
Yes. So the source, what we're talking about, isn't so much about the company. So when we think about companies, often we think about, well, who's on the board or who is a shareholder? And so there's this very formal layer of an organization, the formal structure, I call it. And then beneath that, there's something that I call the creative order, which is just the initiative, the creative idea that the whole thing is really all about. And that's the thing that starts with one person. And initiatives of any age and of any size, they still had a starting point where there was one person who took the first step, the first risk to realize an idea. And if the initiative still seems to have some life in it today, then that means that somewhere there will be one person who's holding it. They may not be fully acknowledged as that person. They may not be taking full responsibility for it. And the initiative might be suffering or not, depending on what's happening. But that role is still incredibly important. And, you know, a wonderful example of this in a very large, old organization is Unilever. And so I think Unilever are being widely recognized for a very old corporate organization, for being one that does seem to be a bit more purposeful and have a real sense of direction that's much more than just about creating shareholder value. And they're by no means perfect, but it's definitely an interesting example to look at. And today, Paul Polman is quite clearly more than just the CEO. So he's not just someone who has a formal position on the board. When you hear him speak, when you read what he writes, he's connected to something a little bit deeper about what this initiative is really all about. But obviously, Paul Polman didn't start Unilever. It's a very old organization. But if you trace the history back, when it was started by William Lever, William Lever was the original source of the organization and had some really clear ideas. I forget exactly how he phrased it, but it was to do with providing sanitation and hygiene to the masses, something along those lines. And that still seems to be in the DNA of Unilever today. And interestingly, when Paul Polman took the position as CEO at Unilever, he went on a bit of a journey himself. He called it walking in William Lever's shoes. And it's fascinating, and maybe even a bit creepy, depending on your viewpoint. But he spent quite a bit of time finding out everything he could about William Lever, about what was this initiative that was started. So again, this is nothing to do with the formal structure, the shareholding, nothing like that. This is what was the idea that this initiative started with. And he went to quite great lengths to do this. So he read everything he could find about William Lever. He even went and stayed in his old house to really feel it. Almost sounds like a spiritual journey almost to me. And it seems like through that process, it's almost as if, to use a metaphor, it was like Paul Polman picked up the torch for the Unilever initiative that William Lever had originally lit. And there might have been other people who held the torch along the way, but certainly you get the impression that Paul Polman is holding it today. And he seems to be doing a good job, and they've got their challenges and they've had their controversies. But I think most people are agreed that in the corporate world, you know, Unilever are setting a good example, and there is a good and interesting and noble idea that's being realised in the world. And I think that's because they've really connected to something that's deeper than the formal organisation that goes all the way back to when it was founded.
So what does that mean? You know, there's a lot of talk about shared leadership and this idea that, you know, of engaging our people and getting leaders. You know, you're not a leader if you're not creating other leaders within your organisation. Does this concept of the source preclude other people from leading within the organisation? What does it actually mean?
It absolutely doesn't preclude people, and it's a really important distinction to make. So it's very easy for what I've been describing to be misunderstood as being a return to the old school command and control, that there's one person, probably a guy at the top, who's telling everyone what to do, who's the hero entrepreneur, the hero leader who has all the ideas, and they command the battle from on high and tell everyone else what to do. It's absolutely not that, and we definitely are seeing a trend away from that being the dominant paradigm, for all the reasons that I'm sure your readers and people watching this will know, that it stifles creativity at the edges. It doesn't get the best out of people. It can be dehumanizing and slow as things go. Messages have to be passed up and down the chain. So it's certainly not a return to the old school command and control. But this is also different to the sort of the postmodern best practice that we hear talked about very widely today, which is about shared purpose, shared vision, creating purpose through a bottom-up process. And I think we're going to start to see an end to that phase, because whilst it has really tried to bring back a lot of the humanity that's missing from the top-down process, what it's often leading to is watered down, diluted, generic statements of purpose, which aren't ultimately accountable to anybody. And when you look at how accountability really works, if you say who's accountable and you say everybody's accountable, that means no one's really accountable for it. If in your office you say who's accountable for putting the bins out, and you say, well, everyone's accountable for putting the bins out, you'll probably find that the bins are still festering in the kitchen at the end of the week. So there's some very simple pragmatic reasons why that doesn't work. But we see this dilution, this watering down, and a lack of accountability. But further than that, it actually just ignores what seems to be true for these organizations. So a great reference to look at for this is Frederick Laloux's book, Reinventing Organizations. And it's a fantastic book. And his work on looking at wholeness inside organizations, so bringing your whole self to work, being human, dropping the mask, fantastic. All of his insights around self-management, so working without the traditional hierarchy in a much more networked, peer-to-peer way, fantastic. But then he talks about evolutionary purpose, this idea that the purpose just bubbles up organically, almost separately from the individuals within it, and is shepherded by the people. It's a really nice romantic idea, but I haven't actually seen any evidence that that's truly happened anywhere, because every single story in his book, and wherever you will find a really progressive, interesting organization, when you look really carefully and honestly at it, you will find that there is a person, an individual, who has really championed that and driven it through. And so to ignore that, it just seems, to me at least, to be ignoring what's right there in front of your face. It's ignoring the evidence. And so I believe that the best strategy is to work with what's natural and what's true, and that is that there is an individual who's really somehow holding the vision, holding the space for the whole. But then within that, not to act as an old school command and control dictator, but to give everybody who wants to the opportunity to carve out whatever portion of responsibility and accountability they want to have within that. So the job is to hold the edge, but to allow people to step up, to be autonomous, and to run their own part of the initiative in their way. And then within their domain, the same rules apply. They become the source for their particular area of responsibility. They recruit people in. And in a way, you can build up a picture of an initiative like a series of concentric circles with lots of initiatives within initiatives that overall contribute to a big idea that's being held by one person. But it does require a different set of behaviours and characteristics from someone who's running such an organisation. And so we don't want the hero entrepreneurs or the dictators of old. We need people, though, who can very strongly hold on to the outside edge of an initiative to make sure that things don't creep in that belong elsewhere, yet at the same time be able to let go of control within it and allow people to take responsibility for areas that are theirs. And that's not always an easy thing to do. And there's a phenomenon that I see, which I call the curse of the humble leader, where you see leaders who've done incredibly well at building and a very progressive initiative at scale. And it's very clear when you hear that person speak, you read about the organization, you talk to employees, that person has been a big source. It is the source of the idea and the inspiration. And part of their strength is their humbleness and the fact that they're not an old school dictator. But when you talk to them, they sometimes say, oh, well, you know, it's not really about me. It's about all of us. And the truth is, it is actually really about them. And if their energy for it and their responsibility for it becomes lacking, then everybody suffers. And so it's a real art to be able to step into this role of being a good source, so really creating clarity over what the vision is, asking for help, allowing people to take portions of responsibility and act autonomously within that without reverting to being a command and control boss, but also without reverting to this almost spineless egalitarianism where we say, hey, you know, everybody's voice is equal, everybody matters, so we'll try and come up with something that everybody agrees with that's not accountable to anybody, which doesn't get the best out of everyone either. And in fact, both cases, you'll lose good people, because if it's overly egalitarian, the best people will just get fed up because they're not able to take full autonomy for something, and they will leave. And likewise, in a dictatorship, the best people leave because they don't want to be treated in that way. But if you have an initiative where people are drawn in by a powerful, inspiring, worthwhile vision, and you know that within that you can step up to take your part in that, then that's a recipe for good collaboration where a big idea is likely to get realized.
So tell me about the qualities then of this kind of person. So we're imagining that within the organization there is the source that's looking after the containing the whole vision or the whole purpose, and then within that there are sources looking after initiatives within. What are some of the most important human qualities of those leaders, those sources?
Yeah. So first of all, it's really important to make a distinction between leadership and being a source. They're almost two different yet related roles. And I expect when it comes to leadership, you probably know more about this than me. This is your area, and you're doing the research in this. And leadership, as you know, is all about people. Whereas sourcing is all about realizing an idea. And it's possible to be a very, very good leader and create a very happy organization where people feel fulfilled. But the question is it actually realizing the idea that the initiative was started with? Is it realizing an idea that someone actually cares about and wants to see happen in the world? This is something slightly different. So we certainly need people to be good leaders. But at the same time, people need to learn to be a source, to be someone who can source an idea and realize it in the world. And that does require some different characteristics. And so a couple of things on this. So at the heart of it, being a good source is about taking full responsibility for your initiative. If you start something and it's based on your need and your idea, no one else can take responsibility for that. If I'm hungry and I want a sandwich, I have to take responsibility for the initiative of getting myself a sandwich. No one else can really do that for me. I can ask for their help, but I need to take responsibility. And the second is about authority. And authority has almost become a taboo in the world of progressive business. People say, we need to get rid of authority. And they're right and they're wrong. They're right in that we've seen the wrong kind of authority. We've seen authority expressed as power over people. I have authority over you. And quite rightly, there's a backlash against that. But authority is also about creativity. So authority comes from the same root as the word author. And so when we talk about who is the authority on a subject and who's the authority on Harry Potter, it's J.K. Rowling. No one else is the authority on it. And if anyone else said they were, then they would be an imposter. And we all know that that's true. And any number of people could probably have a go at writing another Harry Potter book, but it's not going to be the same as when J.K. Rowling does it, because she is the authority. She's the author on it. And so it's really important that when someone is sourcing an initiative, that they stand in their authority as the author of it. And what that means is creating clarity over what's in and what's out. Because if you imagine there's a whole universe of all the possible ideas that humans could realize together, what happens when you source an idea and you start an initiative is it's like you carve out a field within that universe of all possible ideas. And that means that within that field, some things are in and some things are out. And what seems to happen, the way this seems to work, is that the source, the person who starts an initiative, has a real connection and a real felt sense of what's in and what's out. And that's the thing they have authority over. And so what they need to do, as well as taking responsibility for the initiative, is to stand in their authority over what's in and what's out. And that avoids the initiative either drifting or becoming dilute, which happens in many cases with very democratic organizations. They naturally, there's this almost, I call it creative entropy, because more and more stuff creeps in because anyone can start any initiative. And so the next thing you know, the organization is doing 1,000 different things. And that might be okay if that's what the vision is, to create a happy working community where anyone can start any initiative, then that's okay. But if you've started an initiative to do something specific, you don't want it to just become diluted. So learning how to really take responsibility and stand in your authority, both incredibly important. The next characteristic is about being able to listen, because if you have the authority over something, you'll be getting, and probably yourself, Blair, and anyone else who's ever started an initiative or a company, it's almost like you're on the telephone and you're just being bombarded with ideas and possible next steps. And sometimes it can feel quite overwhelming. And in the real world, it's not really a telephone line. It's people giving you ideas, making suggestions. It's things you read. It's the thoughts that you have in the shower or when you're going out for a run or that you wake up with. And it's learning how to listen to all of these things that are all this information that's coming to you, and sift it and starting to work out what's in and what's out and what the next step is. And that's always the key thing, is what's the next step towards realizing whatever the idea happens to be. And in doing that, another really important characteristic is being okay with being in a permanent state of doubt. And this was very reassuring to me when I learned about this. Peter Koenig, who's led the research on this area, he describes it as saying that the chronic state of a source is doubt, of just saying, I don't know what the next step is. And I thought, yeah, I can resonate with that. That was certainly my experience. And the key thing to do when you're sourcing an initiative is to wait for the next step to become clear and then to take the next step. And sometimes that means waiting, and sometimes it means doing nothing at all. And it's important to be clear that that doesn't mean knowing that the next step is going to work out, because failure is part of the process. Sometimes your next steps will be wrong. But knowing that risk, that experiment is the right thing to do, that's still taking the next step. And when you take to the next step, you're at a new point and you need to feel out what needs to happen from there. So being okay with doubt, only acting when the next step has become clear, even if it's not guaranteed to succeed, is really important. And that requires sometimes a slowing down. And we're often told, particularly in entrepreneurial ventures, it's all about, you know, faster, 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 just take the next step, whatever it might be. And actually what needs to happen a little bit more is to spend more time listening, more time feeling out the next step. But then once you are clear, it's taking that next step no matter what. And that's the next characteristic of a good source, is once they are clear and they know with their whole body, not just their brain, they know with their whole body that that's what needs to happen next. They always take that next step. And sometimes that's very easy to do, but sometimes it's really challenging. And what that comes down to is that sometimes to take the next step, you have to be a person or assume an identity that's not necessarily the identity that you want to have. You might have to do something difficult that not everybody is going to be like. You might think, oh, that's the next step. If I do that, I'm going to be a total bastard. And that's when you have to decide what's more important, not being that identity that I'm running away from or realizing the idea. And if it is more important to you to absolutely never be a bastard in your life, then it's probably the wrong decision. It wasn't the next step because it's not helping you to realize your idea. But you might have to reclaim an identity that you're perhaps running away from. And the typical common ones are taking a next step even though it makes you feel insecure. And you see this all the time from people who are in a job, they're in a comfortable rut. They know there's an initiative that they should be starting. They know what their next step is. They know they just need to quit their job and do it, but they don't because they're afraid of being insecure. And so being able to reclaim this identity, to say I'm an insecure person and I love it, is incredibly important. And that again is hard, but very possible. And it can be startlingly quick. Sometimes it's as quick as actually just saying the words out loud and giving yourself a chance to try it on for size, to say I'm insecure and I love it. And at first you might recoil and say, no, it's not okay to be insecure. But sometimes you say it a few times, and I've watched this happen on many occasions, is people will eventually kind of chuckle and laugh and go, I'm insecure and I love it. And they almost shake it off. And when that happens, they're then able to take the next step. And then the final characteristic that I'll give you for now is about the relationship to money. And so it is impossible to talk to anyone about any initiative of any substance without the subject of money coming up. And the relationship to money of the source is probably the number one reason why an idea doesn't get realized. Because people, instead of focusing on the idea and the next step to realize the idea, they focus on trying to make the money work inside the organization that they've set up. This is actually where the research started over 30 years ago by Peter Koenig, and he was looking at large organizations and why it is that leaders start organizations with all these grand plans and visions, and then years later everyone's really busy and maybe some good things are happening, but the idea isn't really materializing in the world. And he figured out that it was to do with the relationship to money. And the way that the money works is it acts as a mirror for these identities that we're seeking. So again, with security, for example, if I'm afraid to be insecure, then there's a good chance that I will see money as security. If I'm looking for freedom, then I might see money as freedom. But reclaiming these mythical powers from the money, because money isn't the thing that makes people secure. There are billionaires who are more insecure than you and I, and there are people with next to nothing who are perfectly secure. Security is about whether or not you live in fear. Likewise with freedom, you can choose to be free the moment you want to. Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning talked about finding freedom in the most horrific conditions in a concentration camp. And if he could find freedom there, I'm pretty sure that most of us, as we're going about our initiatives, can be free. But these powers get projected onto the money. So there's a real need to master your relationship with money, such that money doesn't become the focus. The idea remains the focus, but money becomes a resource that gets attracted in to help you to realize the idea. It doesn't mean forgetting about money. Money management, it doesn't mean getting rid of the whole finance team and not having any idea what's in the bank account. That's a recipe for disaster too. But the difference is what's the focus? Is it trying to make the money work, or is it realizing the idea? And a good source will always focus on realizing the idea. And if you read up on someone like Elon Musk and his incredible journey with SpaceX and with Tesla, you know, he's nearly been bankrupt, but he always somehow manages to remain focused on the idea, not just trying to make the money work. And because of that, he's able to realize something quite special. So that's a few characteristics for you.
So lots that I want to pick up on. So one of the things I'm interested in is the distinction you make between the source and the leader. Because when you talk about these qualities, I'm wondering if there are any other qualities that I would be hoping to see in a leader other than the ones that you've talked about. You know, the very high level of purpose drive, the self-awareness, and the kind of humility that you've talked about are all qualities that I associate with the kind of leadership that we really need from people who are rightly going to call themselves leaders, who deserve the title. And I'm just wondering, so there's some specifics I want to pick up on, but just this general concept, if there are qualities that you think you need to lead that a source doesn't necessarily have, but that are required in the organization.
Yeah, so the key difference is that a source needs to be able to play whatever role and whatever character, if you like, they need to play to realize the idea. And probably most of the time, that will include a character that's a really good leader, because we know that if people are terrible leaders, then it's very difficult to find, to get the help you need to realize your idea. But sometimes you might have to do something that looks like terrible leadership, because that's what's required to realize the idea. And that might be a really difficult choice to make, but it might actually be the most humane choice in the long term, because to keep people working in an initiative where the idea isn't being realized is just a gradual, slow death that people will experience as just a lack of energy. If people have ever worked in an organization where there's no sense of what the big idea is that's being realized, then they might have experienced that firsthand. So you might have to, it transcends in many ways leadership, because yeah, sometimes you might have to even be a bad leader, but probably, yeah, most of the time you'll want to act as a good leader, but you'll do it very consciously. You'll be acting as a good leader in service of realizing the idea, not necessarily as the end in itself. Yeah. And that's probably where this is different from a lot of the traditional thoughts on leadership, which is that we must all be good leaders and we should aspire to be good leaders all of the time. And I would actually argue that isn't always the case. It's probably the case most of the time, but not always.
Yeah, I like that. So then going back to some of the specifics you talked about, one of the things that came out very strongly was this, it's almost a tension between being someone with a very clear sense of purpose and a belief, a sort of self-belief in your right to pursue that, whilst at the same time being humble, listening, not knowing what to do next, waiting. These things might seem to be in conflict. So I'm wondering how hard or how easy it is for an individual to really embody that, to not find themselves leaning more towards one side than the other.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's almost like a continual dance that's going on between being the authority and saying what's in and what's out, at the same time listening to try and feel out what the next steps are, which includes listening to all the people that are in your initiative that are saying, I think this is what needs to happen next. And, you know, perhaps making use of all of these wonderful group processes like Theory U and Art of Hosting that really bring ideas out of groups of people, and really listening to all of that, yet still being able to make the call about saying what's in and what's out. And at the same time, being comfortable with doubt as well, being able to say, I don't know. And it's one of the most powerful things that somebody could say, is just to say, I don't know, I'm in a state of doubt. And also to say that until I know, I'm not going to do anything either. So it is this continual dance between authority and doubt and listening all happening at the same time. But the key to all of this is about honesty. And that means honesty and truthfulness with yourself. My colleague, Charlie Davis, who introduced me to this work, that's how he always frames it, about saying it's about being truthful in your work, because you know deep down when you're doing the thing that you're really supposed to be doing, and it's listening not just with your head, but you feel it in your body. And sometimes to some people that can sound a bit woo-woo, but actually, if you've ever had a feeling in your gut that something is just wrong or something is really right, you feel it with your whole body, not just with the thinking part of your brain. And that truthfulness, that honesty that goes a layer deeper than we can explain purely through a rational conversation. But you know it when you feel it, when something absolutely feels right or wrong. Often very viscerally as well. And it's funny, I've been in conversations where someone has suggested an idea to a source and the source has actually said that they felt physically sick at the thought of doing whatever that thing was. And that's not, and you can post-rationalize that and say, well, this is why that's not a good idea. But listening to the fact that that thing made you feel sick is an important part of the listening exercise. So being above all truthful, so it's truthful about yourself, about who you really are, and about what the next step needs to be. So yeah, that's probably the number one thing.
So the picture you're painting, it sounds beautiful, sounds lovely. And most people work in organizations where work in organizations where it is very dangerous, to be honest, or it feels very dangerous. Mm. That they frequently feel physically repulsed by what they have to do, but it is the environment in which they operate.
Yeah.
And so they are dragged into playing the game of the organization, which is much more about playing nice, playing by the rules of that organization, being seen as high potential, working very, very hard so you can take another step up and take another step up in the hope that as you move up the organization, you'll have more and more freedom, more and more influence to change things. You'll be able to become more honest. In my experience, that isn't often what happens. You're just then really tied in. So then very often the leaders that I'm working with, the very senior guys, wondering what it's all about in the first place. Spent 20, 30 years working their way up this organization, compromising on things they thought were important to get to the top. And even when they get to the top, they realize they can't be the kind of source that they are a source of something. They're just not the source of what they want to be.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is this a theory that applies in certain organizations, or is it something that you as a kind of cog in a wheel, you're a middle manager or a senior manager, or even someone quite senior in an organization that doesn't really operate this way. Is there something that you can do other than just leaving and going and working at Google or something?
It's a really good question. And it is, the conditions are really difficult for a lot of people in many organizations. That's true. And the place where it starts is to ask yourself, why am I in this initiative in the first place? And if we broadly categorize there being two types of people inside organizations, you have employees who are primarily there for the security that the job gives them, which is probably wrapped up in the salary that they have. And if they're doing work that they find really fulfilling and they've got colleagues that they like, they'll probably be pretty happy there if they're being treated well and given some space to do their work in their way. But that's different from someone who joins an organization because they are themselves a source. And a source joins an organization because they know that they've got their own creative passion burning within them that they're going to realize with or without this particular job or this organization. And they sense that the organization, and what they're really sensing is that the source of that organization has created a good space where they can realize their own ideas. And it's really cruel to treat a source like an employee and equally like an employee like a source, because if someone's there mostly for the security and to enjoy the work they do, and you say to them, well, you have to discover your own personal purpose and you must connect everything you do to the big lofty purpose of the organization, that just might not be possible for them, and it might not be true for them, and it might not actually matter because they might be doing a fantastic job. And likewise, if you have a source working in an organization, if you just treat them like an employee and say, well, we're going to pay you really well, you'll feel secure because of the salary, but you must basically do what you're told, then that's not going to work for that person either. And so it's a really important job to, first of all, understand where you are. And everyone has the ability to be a source, because we're all humans and we're all creative animals. Any human being is capable of having an idea and realizing it. The question is just how much do we choose to do that in our lives, or how much do we avoid doing that because we're perhaps worried about feeling insecure by really pursuing our ideas. And so if someone is in an organization where they are feeling frustrated and unfulfilled, they need to ask themselves, why am I actually here? And if you are a source, then you've got two options. You've got to either start asserting yourself and, you know, behaving, maybe being more of a troublemaker, and to put your head above the parapet and try and change things and try and make that into an environment where you can realize your ideas. And a good way to do that is to try and find out what the initiative is really all about. To forget the fact that you work for some FTSE 100 listed company, but say underneath that, like Unilever, say, what is this place really all about? What was the initiative? What was the idea that was being realized? And if you can figure out what that is and who's holding the vision, connect to that. And if that's a good environment for you to realize your ideas, then you've got a good chance of being able to do that. Or if that's not possible, then as you say, the best thing you can do for yourself is to leave and find another initiative where you can be creative and realize your ideas, or to start your own initiative. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about how to change big companies. And we know that it's really hard to do that from the middle. There's this, I think, myth that you find the change makers in the organization and you connect them up and that creates a movement and the organization changes. I see little or no evidence that that's ever really worked. In top-down organizations, it's only really changed when the top has changed. And the people in the middle often get burnt out and frustrated and leave. But if we reframe that and to say, well, instead of trying to change the organization, the idea is to help people who are creative to be creative, then if those people, they don't have to leave frustrated, they leave because they realize they can be more creative elsewhere. And it's a positive step out of the organization. Or it does get noticed and other people say, well, I want to be creative too. And it might be that the organization needs to and will just die, and that'd be a really good thing. There are plenty of companies out there where there is nothing creative happening there at all, and the world wouldn't miss them at all if they went away, and the people would find excellent things to do in its absence. And so sometimes the best thing for an initiative is for it to die. If it's just run out of steam, it's no longer a good environment where something creative is being realized.
It's almost as though you're making a choice about whether your work is where you're going to find your sense of purpose or not, and that it can be fine to not.
Exactly.
And either to, because your purpose is outside of the organization and so doing your work facilitates that, or just because you don't have a high and mighty purpose and you don't, that's not the way that life feels important. That's not what feels important to you about life.
Yeah.
And if you are going to make this acknowledgement that you do have a purpose, or that you want to pursue a purpose, and that purpose is something you want to make your professional life about, then I guess what you're saying is you have to think about your career slightly differently. That you may have to forego some of the conventional badges of success in favor of pursuing that purpose, because the two things may not be able to be aligned. You may be lucky, you may be fortunate and find that your pursuit of purpose is recognized by your organization, even if you're something of a maverick in that organization, but not necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a couple of really important points. So to go back to the original question that you asked about going back to people, whether they have a sense of purpose or not, you know, there's that famous cliched story about JFK walking around the NASA headquarters and asks one of the cleaners what they're doing. He says, I'm helping to put a man on the moon. And everyone says, oh, that's brilliant. That's a purposeful initiative. And you think, yeah, that's great. If that person is connected to the bigger vision of what everybody there is doing, then fantastic. But to expect every cleaner to really be there and caring about putting a man on the moon, that's just not necessarily truthful. And if someone's there because earning the money puts food on the table for their kids and they get treated well and they don't mind being a cleaner, then that's okay. And we should let them do that. You don't have to say you have to find your personal purpose in life. You have to subscribe to this higher purpose and think about that with everything you do. But it's really important then to not completely throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I'm starting to see this happen now, that there's almost like this purpose backlash for exactly that reason, and saying, you know, we shouldn't be trying to create these really purposeful organizations, because so many people are just there for the, you know, for the security and other reasons. And whilst that's true, you need to do both at the same time. For the people who do want to connect to a higher purpose and who do have their own idea that they want to realize, if there is someone at NASA that just wants to make wheels for space shuttles, I don't know, then that's a great place for them to be, and they should be able to realize that idea. And if they want to help, if they want that idea to be a part of something bigger, then great. But let's not force everyone to be exactly the same. And then your second point about, yeah, people having to perhaps forego what they thought their career might have been about. And that's exactly the journey of becoming a source and saying, okay, and what will be going through someone's head, perhaps subconsciously, is saying, okay, if I quit my job and I do the thing that I really want to do, I might fail, or I might not be seen as successful. And so the identity that they're running away from is the unsuccessful me. And the truth is, we're all successful and unsuccessful at different times. And a human being that was incapable of being unsuccessful is probably not really a human being, and probably not, would just be a weird person to be around, wouldn't they? We're all unsuccessful. And so the choice is, can I love the unsuccessful me? And can it be okay to be unsuccessful? And if you say, yeah, I'm unsuccessful and I love it, then that might be the step that person needs to take to stick their head above the parapet and not care about the consequences if they know it's the right thing to do, or to quit and say, I'm starting that thing that I've always known I need to start, or I'm going to quit the big company and go and join this crazy startup that might well fail, but I love the idea that it was founded with, and I want to help realize it and be creative there and get over the fact that it makes them feel insecure, unsuccessful. They might feel like they're not being a provider to their family. You know, these can feel very real. But if you can work through those things, that's the thing that helps you to be a really creative person. And the fascinating thing is when you meet a source, and hopefully having talked about some of these characteristics, you'll think about people you know who behave in this way, who live a life which is in the pursuit of realizing ideas. And sometimes they have an idea and they recruit people in to help them. And other times they join somebody else because they think that somebody else is trying to do something cool over there, and they help them with that. And you will always find that somehow those people have a way of having their needs in life met. They're not necessarily the richest people. Sometimes they're rich and sometimes they're poor. But they're creatively fulfilled. And that pursuit of following ideas rather than following the money or following this or an aversion to being insecure or unsuccessful, somehow that path in life tends to lead to people leading a good life, to have a life well lived by their own standards.
Is this something, so I'm wondering, it might be a bit too personal this question, but you know, I gave you quite a big build up at the beginning and Nixon McInnes thing, and you're not part of Nixon McInnes now. And I just wonder if for yourself, well, there isn't a Nixon McInnes now. Mm. You've gone your separate ways to pursue your own initiatives. And I just wonder if there was something for you when you walked away from that, of what will people think? Will people think that we failed? Will people think that I failed? Was that something you experienced?
Oh, yes, definitely. And, you know, it was such an incredible learning experience with my own company, because I experienced leaving with what some people would describe as a degree of success. You know, I sold some shares and left and was able to travel around the world and all the rest of it, and then was drawn back to the company years later and was part of a turnaround of it. And then at the end, we realized I realized the initiative had run its course. It was done, and it was time to close it. But that was an act more of creative destruction, because while one thing closed, it allowed a whole bunch of new initiatives to pop up and allow people to do the thing that they really wanted to do. But yeah, absolutely. And I can remember some dark days. You know, we were fortunate that we made the money work throughout the process. So the company didn't go bust, and we ended up selling it to somebody else. But yeah, for some dark days when I thought that the sky really was falling in, and I did think about my reputation. I'm going to look unsuccessful. I'm going to look like a failure. And I had to sit there and say, I'm a failure and it's okay. I'm unsuccessful and it's okay. Because if all I did was run away from the risk of failure or being unsuccessful, we could have kept that company going for years. You know, we'd been in business for 15 years. We'd rode many ups and downs. We'd survived recessions and all kinds of issues that the businesses face. There was always a way to continue. But actually, in this case, it was done. And so to make that call, you know, required being able to stare at these identities that perhaps I would have been afraid of, and we took it, and it was really difficult, and we got through it, and everyone's okay, and I think we're more creative than we ever were before. We're now actually focused on the things we wanted to do rather than trying to make the money work and following an idea that had actually run its course.
We're sort of coming to the end of the interview, I think, and I found this absolutely fascinating to hear about this way of working and about this way of being and the choices. There's obviously something very hard about the way that a lot of people work today. I mean, I see it in their faces when I'm working with teams. I see the dark circles under their eyes. I see the stress. I certainly hear very frequently, we don't really have time for this. I mean, we don't really have time to spend thinking, talking, and getting to know each other, because when we get back to work, we've got a million things, all of which are important, that we need to do. So I'm just wondering how you overcome it, because that's hard. But then there's what you're describing is also hard. The being true to yourself, being honest, sitting with that insecurity, sometimes the financial insecurity, certainly some self-esteem insecurity. Which one do you think is harder?
That's a really good question, isn't it? Well, you know, I think that when you describe that difficulty and just that heaviness about how life is in many corporate organizations, and you look at why they've become that way, because actually, the Industrial Revolution and these corporate companies, they've done a lot. They've churned out a lot of products, and there's been progress in so many areas, and we all have iPhones in our pockets now and all the rest of it. And that's as a result of those kinds of organizations. But the way my colleague Charlie describes this is that what those organizations are optimized for is productivity. And they are really productive. Everyone works damn hard, and they get a lot done in spite of all of the difficulties and the politics and the stress. They are very productive environments, but it comes at a cost. And that cost is the productivity is at the expense of human needs, of the real needs of people to feel a sense of meaning in their lives, to feel a sense of connection, security, whatever it might be. That's the thing, that's the real cost. And so we have people being very productive whose needs in life aren't really being met. And so the big transition is moving away from just focusing on productivity and focusing on needs. That's where all of this starts. And when someone sources an initiative and starts something new, really that's an expression of a need they have, right from me making in a sandwich because I feel this need for food and I'm hungry, and then I have an idea that I can make a sandwich. You know, in the same way William Lever had this need, probably rooted in compassion and contribution, that he wanted to see a world where people had access to hygiene, and he had an idea that he could create and bring products into the world, and realized that. And so if we start to reconnect to needs, to think, what is it I really need, what's really driving me, and put that at the heart of it, that's when we'll have more successful initiatives. But that can only happen at an individual level, and a big mistake is people are focusing on the company or the organization. We say we have to reinvent organizations, and I really disagree with that. I think it's a total distraction, because the organization doesn't really exist, and it sounds bizarre to say that because they seem so real. But Google doesn't really exist. It's a story. It's a logo, and there are pieces of paper that say that it exists, and people turn up to work every day. But Google really is an idea, and underneath it, it's an initiative that was started by Larry Page, working very closely with Sergey Brin, to realize something. So if we focus on people, and that can start with anybody, because anybody at any moment in their life can look inwards and ask themselves, what do I need? What do I need? And when you do that and you focus on the need and you focus on ideas to meet your need, and that becomes the focus, then that's being a source. And I think that when people do that, that's when initiatives will very naturally create more of a positive contribution in the world. You know, you mentioned some of the corporate clients I've worked with over the years at the beginning of this interview, you know, and some of those places aren't really full of creativity and human needs. In fact, they're often very productive and making a lot of money. But if people reconnect to their needs, then the organizations and the initiatives will sort themselves out, and many will die, and new initiatives will grow in their place. Nothing will be wasted. And so if there's one message to take from all of this, that's what it's really all about, is connecting to human needs and trying to meet those and connect to other people and help them to meet their needs too.
Thank you, Tom.
My pleasure. Thanks, Blair.
So that was Tom Nixon. See what I mean? Really, really interesting stuff. I really loved a couple of things in that interview. This idea that he talked about waiting for the next stage to emerge. So taking a step and then waiting rather than just continuing in action. And I also loved this idea, and I've used it many times, talked about it many times with clients, of there being different types of people in an organization, people who are basically employees and people who are driven by purpose. And when you treat those people as if they're the same creature, in a sense, you really get yourself into quite a lot of difficulty. It might also make sense, of course, to know which one you are. So that's it for today. Next week, I am hoping to bring you a real scoop. This is an interview with two of my heroes, Emily Thompson and Kathleen Shannon from the Being Boss podcast. This is a show that I listen to when I'm driving to meetings, when I'm on aeroplanes, when I'm in hotel rooms. These ladies are absolutely incredible. And I really encourage you to listen out to the Being Boss podcast between now and the next show. Really check out that show so you've got some idea of them and how amazing they are. And barring any technical issues, I'm speaking to them on Thursday, and I won't delay in getting that interview out there to you as soon as possible. So I can't wait for that. I'm sure it's going to be brilliant. They are hugely entertaining, a little bit rude, really just my kind of people. So that's next week. But in the meantime, with a little bit more information about Tom and how you can find out more about him and how you can stay in touch with us, here's the lovely Ivy Palmer.
You can find out more about Tom Nixon at tomnixon.co.uk. His new project is called Mapteo.com, which is a mapping tool for self-managing organisations. Go to Mapteo.com to sign up for updates as that project progresses. Don't forget to visit our website, thatpeoplething.com. Cheers. To find out more about how we work with individuals, teams and whole organisations, and how to book Mummy for your next conference. And please rate and review this podcast on iTunes. Puppy eyes, puppy eyes. Thank you for listening.